we live in an unprecedented era of tennis genius.
Oh, that is unbelievable!
And it just keeps on getting better.
Oh, what a scorching return!
Analysis, debate, and exclusive interviews.
Can you believe it?
This is the Tennis Weekly Podcast with Adam Bates.
On the Tennis Weekly menu today, Laura Robson makes her first WTA semi-final. Roger Federer has now officially spent longer at number one than anybody else. I speak to one of his best mates and former doubles partner. We take a peek into the future of computerized rackets, and we listen to Alexander Dolgopolov's rapping skills. Intrigued? It's all here on Tennis Weekly.
Tennis Weekly is a Sky Sports News Radio podcast.
Adam Bates with you as ever, and our guest this time round is former British number one and now commentator and coach Chris Wilkinson. And after Johnny Murray's doubles title and Murray reaching the first Wimbledon final that he ever has last week, we have more British success to speak of. Laura Robson was in Palermo last week and she beat the second seed, Roberta Vinci, who is the highest player at 27 in the world that she's ever overcome. Then she knocked out Carla Suarez Navarro and looked set to knock out another seed in Barbara Sakhlavova-Strytsova in straight sets in the semis, but 18 double faults helped put paid to her chances there. But, Chris, let's focus on the positive. And what a terrific week it was for her.
It was, yeah, it's very true. I mean, the names you mentioned there are good quality players, players of a lot of experience. And what I think it's so important, I think, after Wimbledon, is to play well. I think Laura would have taken a lot of confidence, you know, not only from the Wimbledon, but the other tournaments at Eastbourne and in Birmingham. And, you know, I think it's very important for players, you know, certainly British players, is people kind of associate, you know, good players at Wimbledon. But it's what you do outside of Wimbledon that's as important. So Laura was able to go to clay courts and play, you know, some good tennis that week as well. So it just shows that she has potential to actually mix it with some of the best players in the world.
And especially, as you say, because it was on clay, which is supposed to be the surface that least suits her game. So it should leave us optimistic about what she can achieve on other surfaces, shouldn't it?
It should do, absolutely. And you know, I think the way she plays, the movement's not part of her best. She's got some big weapons. She's got a good serve. So to be able to do it on clay, I think, is exceptional. So when she does play on a surface that is comfortable for her, the grass courts, the hard courts, and, you know, more or less the quicker courts, then hopefully, you know, I think clay is a good stamping ground for her to improve the whole of the game as well.
Well, it will take her up to a career-high ranking of what should be 91, but we can't be sure at the time of recording until the rankings are officially released. But she'll almost definitely get straight into the main draw of the US Open and won't have to go through qualifying. And you, Chris, you're somebody who has experience in both scenarios at majors, and I imagine it makes a huge difference.
It does. I mean, the qualifying is tough to get through because you've got to win three rounds to get into the main draw. And all those guys or girls in the qualifying are good players. The depth is always good. So, you know, it's different with the heat and, you know, the weather conditions and the sort of surroundings are different. So, you know, it's important to get in the main draw. When you get in the main draw, you've got a good chance and you have a good day, you get through, you build some confidence, and you know, then you end up playing some of the best players. And you know, confidence and belief is so important in the game. And you know, Laura's able to do that from the Wimbledon, going to Palermo, playing some good tennis, and hopefully she can transfer that into the American hardcourt season.
Yeah, she's had Lucy Arle, a former British number one on the women's side of things, coaching her in the past week, and they look very relaxed together, which perhaps you could say was down to a honeymoon period. I mean, do they exist in tennis? Between coaches and players?
I think certain coaches and players gel. I think it happens. I know Lucy very well. I do a lot of work with Lucy. She's a good, solid professional. She'll say how it is. She's pretty chilled as well. I think Laura's sort of been a bit unsettled with coaches over the last sort of 6 months to a year. So maybe Lucy will be ideal for Laura Robson. I think it's just one of those, you know, sometimes you put two people together And it just works. And obviously it's success for, you know, Laura as well. It's a good success for Lucy. So obviously the combination of both players together is working well.
Well, let's round up Brit watch elsewhere then. Heather Watson made the second round of Stanford in the States in the singles after a win over the higher ranked young American Sloane Stephens. And that'll see her climb up to a career high ranking of what is expected to be 71, which will then see her usurp Anne Kyodobong and become the British number one for the very first time. How does it feel when that moment arrives, Chris?
Oh, it's a great feeling. I mean, it's what you play for, isn't it? For rankings, and to be able to turn back, you know, years to come, to you were number one in that sport, in your country, you know, is quite something. Again, it's another one of those where she's benefited from the confidence she gained from Wimbledon. I saw her play on she won a great match on centre court at Wimbledon, and from that got a lot of confidence. So, as I said, it's a case of trying to take that away from this British scene and put it onto the world scene. And, you know, obviously from her point of view, now British number one. I mean, it's great, but it's also good you've got, you know, you've mentioned four ladies there who are competing together. You know, you get a good group and they tend to push each other. So you've got Watson, obviously you've got Robson, you've got Hilton, you've got Baltatra as well, and hopefully we can get a few more coming up. Then you've got a good core of players playing.
So you mentioned the other two there. From a player's perspective, Chris, when you were at the top of the game in Britain, honestly, did you want competition from compatriots, or do players actually prefer to remain the best in the nation without any challenges?
It's a difficult one because you don't really think about it because you're concentrating on what you're doing. That's the most important thing, becoming a better player. I do think it helps, though, if you've got two or three behind that are improving their ranking as well, because what happens is you can go away with them, you can practice with them, you go to the same tournaments. It just creates a good feeling. And, you know, a competition is healthy. If you can have more of that, then it can push you on to better results.
Well, as well as her success in the singles, Heather Watson has actually made the final of the doubles as well, alongside the New Zealander Marina Arakovic. Forgive us for not staying up all night to bring you that result. Anne Kyothavong, though, she lost in the opening round of Stanford to the 21-year-old wildcard American Mallory Burdett, who doesn't have a singles ranking and had only won one match before that in her entire professional career. While Elena Baltacha, she hasn't played in the past week, but she slipped from British number one to British number four in the space of 6 weeks, which is astonishing. Do you feel there's a bit of a transition period going on here, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of the new coming in and the old going sort of out a little bit. It's not meant to be a harsh thing to say. I think it's good because obviously the young kids will come through. Hopefully the older ones now will think, okay, you know, you got to step up your game a little bit, because I guess it can be easy to get, you know, content with being number one and two in the country, certain ranking inside the top 100. So, as I mentioned, if you've got a few sort of fighting for certain slots, then obviously it's that much better. But as you do get older, things happen. You know, the motivation becomes different. You know, maybe you get a few more injuries that you might not have had as a youngster. So it's different times in your life.
The title in Palermo went to Sara Errani as she overcame Robson's conqueror Sakhlavova Strytsova for her 11th title of 2012 across singles and doubles. That is pretty remarkable. And after we've finished recording, Serena Williams will play the lucky loser Coco van der Wey in the final of Stanford, looking for her fourth singles title of the year. But she's been making the news away from the tennis court as well, because Serena is going to lend her voice to an animated film called, now get this, Wimbletoad. And she's going to be the executive producer of it as well. Would you like to know what it's about, Chris?
Tell me. I'll see what you did there with that Wimbletoad. It's very good.
That's what it's called. I didn't do anything. The film is going to be called Wimbletoad, and it's about an orphan toad called Henry who plays tennis to win freedom from a businessman who's the baddie and is trying to take over the Wimbletoad tournament and destroy the orphanage in the process. So fingers crossed we've got tickets for the premiere of that one.
I hate to say I won't be rushing out.
Serena's not the only one looking to exhibit her talents off the court, as we'll hear about a little bit later.
This is the Tennis Weekly Podcast with Adam Bates.
I admit, last year, when Roger Federer went down to number four in the world, I said that there was no way he was going to win another major, and absolutely no chance that he was going to return to number one. But you may have heard that last week that happened. And with the release of Monday's rankings, he will have held the number one ranking for a total of 287 weeks. And he breaks another of Pete Sampras's records. It really is a bamboozling achievement, and one that has delighted his good pal Yves Allegro, who acted as Roger's older brother when they lived together during Federer's late teens. And they've continued to be very close and won tournaments together in doubles. But talking about the new record, Allegro doesn't believe it was among Roger's main objectives.
I think what's more important for him is to win another slam, to win Wimbledon again, which is by far his favourite tournament. So I think that's huge, and to have twin in the stadium after winning, I think it's something very special to him. I think he will remember this one as probably one of the best slams he won.
Let's go back in time, Yves. And what was it like when you first got to know him as a younger lodger when he attended the Swiss Tennis Centre in BL, age 16? I've read he was pretty lazy around the house.
Well, he was different than now, obviously. I mean, he was a little kid. He had a lot of temper on court. but I think his dream was to become number one and win a slam. But like a lot of kids, that at 16 you could, or at 15 you couldn't say will become so, but he did his way and he did pretty well.
At that age, how good did you think he would go on to be?
Well, the first time I thought he would become very good was with 16. He came back from Italy and won ITF under 18 tournament with 16. And I thought, wow, I played this tournament 1 year ago and lost in the quarters. And these tournaments are great, and he's 16 and he's winning it. That's huge. And then with 17, he won Wimbledon Juniors. He became number one at the end of the year. He won the Orange Bowl, and then you thought, oh, well, this guy will do his way. But you could never say he will become the best player ever. You could maybe say, well, he will maybe win a slam or something.
And you mentioned there his anger problem. How much of an issue was that in those days?
Well, it was a problem. He had a bad temper in practice and in matches. But he was never giving up in matches. He was always fighting. But his temper was not helping him. And after a couple of years on the ATP Tour, he realized if you want to win, you have to control your temper. And he found a way slowly to control it and found a perfect balance.
And now, despite having won almost everything there is to win in the game, and he's got a family and lorry loads of money and all the rest of it, but it still seems, Eve, as if his love for the game is undiminished.
He loves the game so much that he wants more. He just wants to play. And now that he won everything, maybe he can even enjoy it more. And daughter are older, and they realize now what daddy is doing. I think it's something special for him to play in front of his kids and his family. He loves the travel. He loves the ambiance on the tour. And I would not be surprised if he played 3 or 4 more years. I think even he doesn't really know when he will stop.
Well, you retired, didn't you, Eve, last September after a successful doubles career on the ATP Tour and in the Davis Cup and the Olympics. And now you're dedicating your time to helping what you hope will be the next Swiss superstars.
Well, I think I realised that in Switzerland, I think the people involved in tennis realised that we won't have another Roger Federer in the in the future. But for us to produce in the future players like maybe Wawrinka, which is already an unbelievable player, he was top 10. Will be already huge. So that's our goal, that in the next 5 to 10 years, we have another 1 or 2 top 100, the top 50 in the boys' side and the girls' side.
Do you hope that Roger himself will one day play a part in this?
Well, he's already asking a lot about my job, about the kids, the name. So he knows the name, he knows the results. He's very interested. But I think first he has a lot of things to do, but we will try maybe to get him a little bit involved in the future.
This is the Tennis Weekly Podcast.
The now head of under-14s in Swiss tennis, Yves Allegro, and he says actually there are a couple of good juniors coming through now, including the Wimbledon Junior Doubles finalist Belinda Bencic and also Marco Osmacic, who won the prestigious Futures Aces tournament in France and got to play doubles with Jim Courier and Andre Agassi as a prize. What a dream that is. But back to Roger Federer. There are many positive things about the man, Chris, but the one thing I want to ask you is that if there were just one aspect of Roger Federer you would use as an example for the kids that you coach, what would it be?
I think in the way he plays, variety. You know, watching him play the final against Murray, the variety of shots he had on the day, the slice backhand, over the backhand, was incredible. His first strike tennis was incredible. So it was like the serve wide, then the second ball was, you know, pretty much inspirational. Also, the belief, you know, the belief that he's got from keep coming back time and time again.
I'd go for his cool exterior that he manages to put on. It's like a piece of body armour. And the way he manages to look completely tranquil, no matter what's going on. And that's how he creates an aura about himself. And he buys a few games against some lesser players just through his reputation alone. And that is something I would try and teach my kids if I was coaching them. But I don't coach kids, so it's probably best that I don't try to. But is he a goat, Chris?
Is he a goat? What do you mean by goat?
I'm testing your tennis acronym knowledge. Greatest of all time. Is he the greatest?
For me, yes. 7, you know, Wimbledon's 17 Grand Slam titles now, and you know, won all 4 majors. I mean, you know, yes, for me, definitely, as it's not in doubt.
Well, let's move on then. And there are 4 men's tournaments that have been going on in the past week. Plenty of success for the seeds as well. In the final of Borstad in Sweden, David Ferrer demolished his fellow Spaniard Nicolas Almagro 6-2, 6-2, though Almagro has been suffering with a significant shoulder injury. Nevertheless, I'm in danger of gushing over Ferrer again, but it's because he just keeps on winning. It's his fifth title of the year, and nobody has won more titles nor matches than the 30-year-old. In 2012, he's just an irrepressible Trojan.
He is incredible. His work rate is so good, and he maximises everything he's got. He's, you know, one of the toughest players to beat on the tour. You've got to be on, you know, on your A game to be able to beat him. And, you know, he was unfortunate at Wimbledon, because I think if he could have got that second set against Murray, he would have won. But, you know, Ferrer, I commentated on the match where he played Del Potro. Very, very solid. He gives you nothing. You really have to be mentally tough. And he's achieved so much in the game.
Oh, he was sublime against Del Potro, wasn't he? But the other stat about him is that he has also won 8 Bagel sets this year now, which is 8 sets, 6 love. Which is more than any other player, apart from one man, who has the same tally. Now, can you guess who the other one is? I'll give you a clue. He's from Argentina.
Are we talking about Del Potro?
I'll give you another guess.
Are we talking about Nalbandian?
No. Get this. It is Carlos Berlock.
Carlos Berlock. Of course it is, yeah.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Well, the two top seeds also faced each other in the final of Stuttgart, where Janko Tipsarevic has won his first ever clay court final. He nearly threw it away. He was 6-4, 4-love up, but then won it 6-3 in the third against another Argentine, Juan Monaco. In the last grass court event of the year, after this has been recorded, John Isner will take on wildcard Leighton Hewitt, who became the first former world number one to reach the final there since 1973. He did have a kind draw, mind, but he's another man who keeps on defying logic, really, doesn't he? He continues to come back from his, hip and ankle surgeries, and he's 31 now. Chris, why do you think so many players are able to compete at the highest level at the moment in their 30s? And I asked this because there were 34 men who were at least 30 in the Wimbledon draw. Now, is it just because the youngsters are finding it harder to make an impact because the game is a little slower? So they have to be physically stronger to chase down more balls. Is that what it is?
I think it's a combination. I think fitness-wise, I think because of the rehab that's available these days, the players can stay fitter longer. I think that's a big issue, so it gives them a longer lifespan. And I think, you know, we talk about the Hewitts and, you know, even people like the Stepaniks and, you know, Federer. I mean, they love the game. You know, I think it's important that you know, nowadays player actually they enjoy going back to tournaments. They enjoy it. They want to keep competing. So it makes that longevity that much longer, and it's tougher for the younger. I mean, the average age now is about 25, 26 on the tour. So it just shows that you know, if you hang in there long enough, then you can have a longer career.
So in the other ATP tournament this week in Umag, Marcel Granollers and Marin Cilic made the final after the Queen's champion knocked out Alexander Dolgopolov in the semis, but at least that allows the Ukrainian to concentrate on his music career. Now, I say that because on Thursday night, after his quarter-final win, he took to the stage to perform a duet to entertain the Croatian crowd. We can hear a little bit of that now. It's going good, it's going great. I'm Superman with a wing on his back. She's doing slain, but when it's bad, it's awful. I feel so ashamed. I stab who's that too. I don't even know his name. I lay hands on. I'll never stoop so low again. I guess I don't know my own strength. Snoop Doggy Dolgopolov with his version of an Eminem and Rihanna song there. I presume he was doing the Eminem part. Are you buying that, Chris? Are you liking that?
Very good. I prefer that than maybe the move that Serena's going to do, I have to say. It sounded very good. I mean, I've seen him at some of the players' parties and what have you, and he's quite a character, it has to be said. Dolgopolov is. He likes to get involved. He likes to show his side. And it's good. It's like Djokovic as well, with all the you know, the impressions. I think it's good that the players, you know, let people understand what they're like, and that's why it was so refreshing seeing Murray at the end of his match against Federer. You know, his emotions, you know, people can understand that, they can deal with that. And it's, I think it's a great thing to see.
Yeah, Djokovic is brilliant at those impressions, isn't he? He hasn't done them so much recently. Other musical talents, in inverted commas, from the tennis game. Andy Murray, he's done his own little bit of rapping. Do you remember that on the Bryan Brothers pop song recently? Caroline Wozniacki this year, she released a song which we can forgive her for because it was for charity, but that was truly dreadful. And Serena Williams herself, she's had a go at some rapping as well. Have you heard all these?
I haven't, no.
You're missing out. Get onto the internet and look them up and waste some time. Okay. Was there any of this going on in your day, Chris?
Yeah, I think quite a few of the players I remember playing guitars. I think know, when you're traveling the world and you're in hotel rooms, you know, what do you do to kill time? And I know a lot of players used to take their guitars around. And you remember the Jensen brothers, American team who won the French Open one year? They used to play, you know, rock guitar and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's a case of music is a good way of keeping you occupied.
Right, well, let's forget music for now and move on to something a little bit more gripping. It's 25 years since the last wooden racket was used at Wimbledon, as they were gradually rendered extinct by modern graphite ones. But that might not be the last major transition, because one company believes it can revolutionise the game by further introducing a computerised interactive racket that looks and feels just like any other. And Thomas Auton from Babola tells us exactly what the Play and Connect racket is.
It's the first communicating and interactive racket. It will very simply allow players to better analyze their game thanks to information sent by the racket to digital devices.
What kind of information can it tell us?
Many kinds of information. All tennis players will be able to have information like qualification of strokes. Is it a backhand, a forehand? Number of strokes, like where the ball hits the string bed, the ball impact zone, the power of my shot, spin, what is it, a top spin, is it a slice, is it a flat shot? All these type of shots, you'll be able to have the information.
Where did the idea come from to develop this sort of technology?
The first time we had the idea was 10 years ago, but at that time we didn't have the technology to be able to develop it. As you said in an introduction, it was key for us that the player doesn't feel any difference, that he doesn't feel the sensors, because there are sensors in the handle when he's playing. Once you have this information, of course, obviously, it will help you to progress, compare from one training session to the other, from one set to the second to the third, make the difference. How powerful did I serve in third set compared to first set? That makes a big difference. And all this information, you'll be able to access to it, and if you want, share it with friends, compare with other players, etc.
Well, if I was playing, I wouldn't want to share it with my friends, because I don't want them to know how terrible I am. But I'm interested in finding out exactly how the technology works. You said there were sensors in the handle.
Yes, very different kinds of sensors in the handle that are positioned by adjusting the distribution of weight, so there is no difference as compared to a standard model. This is really important. We know that in tennis, the racket is like the following of the arm. It's a tool for a lot of players, and we wouldn't want to change any sensation. So no differences in terms of balance, weight of the racket, exactly the same. And then these sensors in the handle send the data through either Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or even a USB cord. It's pretty funny, because when you open the butt cap, you can plug your racket to a computer to have direct USB connection. And this is how it works.
But the thing is, some of the balls that they will be striking will be hit at around 140 miles per hour. So the racket is going to take a bit of a beating. How have you made sure that it will stay strong enough to withstand those blows?
Of course, we are doing plenty of tests internally to make sure that when you hit very hard, or even when you throw your racket, there's no impact on the technology. These sensors are so small. This is why we waited quite a long time. I mean, we thought of the idea 10 years ago, but we really tried to work on it 3 or 4 years ago, because it was only then that our partner, which is a technological partner specialized in movement capture, enabled us to have the right technology to be able to have small enough sensors not to change the sensations, and also make sure you could shake your racket, do whatever you want with your racket, the technology won't move.
What's the feedback been from the players? You debuted this at Roland Garros, and you let Songa, Nadal, Clijsters, Linar have a go. What did they say about it?
They were really crazy about this technology. We had people sitting in the outside the court, near the court, with their tablets, and these tablets recorded exactly everything that was happening live on the court. I mean, Rafa was doing a forehand with some slice or with some top spin, and you would see exactly these type of information directly on the devices. We also had a link to the giant screen, you know, on the central court of the major tournaments, you have giant screens. Well, here you would have this information. So the players were really impressed. I know Kim told us that she would have liked to have this at the start of her career. So, and of course, the most impressed was Tony Nadal, Rafa's uncle and coach, because for him, it's really interesting to have at last some tangible, some factual information about Rafa's game.
That is fascinating. Tony Nadal is a very difficult man to impress. When do you envisage the first player actually using one of these rackets on court?
The important thing to know is this racket is really for all types of players. I would almost say that the recreational or intermediate players need this technology even more. The launch of the racket is scheduled for 2013. We don't know the exact month yet.
So you're saying that I could go to a shop, pick one of these rackets up in a year or so's time. How much would it set me back?
We don't communicate on the exact costs yet. First, we want it to be the racket of the future. That means that everybody in maybe 5 or 10 years play with this racket, which means we need to have this racket accessible. So it won't be a crazy price. It will be an accessible price.
Right, well, finally, I'm intrigued because you said that you first came up with the idea for this interactive Play and Connect racket 10 years ago. So what are your plans for what kind of rackets we'll have in 10 years' time from now?
For sure, information restitution. You know, it's like when we went from silent movies to talking movies. For us, it's so obvious. I mean, if you have the choice between a non-animated racket and an animated racket which talks, of course, you'll take the talking one because you have so many more information, be able to progress faster, have fun. In 10 years, I really think all the rackets will have this technology. And then why not other products? I mean, balls, shoes, strings. So why not?
This is the Tennis Weekly Podcast.
Chris, as a coach, would you find that useful, that kind of racket? Would you be able to use that on the practice court with the player and actually get some benefit out of it?
I need to know a bit more about the information given, because obviously when you play a match, what is important to a player is the stats you get. So first serve percentage, you know, shot placement, return serve, unforced errors, winners. So pretty much got all of that anyway. But I guess where that could go is it make it a bit more interaction with the crowd, perhaps. It'd be interesting to see the different spins maybe coming off the racket would be of interest, the slice or top spin or side spin, whatever the shot may be. I think all information is good information if it helps you become a better player.
Well, I'm quite excited by it anyway, but back to the tournaments in hand then. And over the weekend, there were no fewer than 11 ATP and WTA events on at the same time, some of them only at the qualifying stages. But here's Mikey Pereira to tell us what we've got to look forward to this week.
Busy week coming up for the men's and women's game. Biggest event for the men is the 500 series event in Hamburg. Defending champ Gilles Simon returns, but a tough field stands in his way. Spaniard Almagro is number one seed and German favourite Tommy Haas has been given a wild card. Across the pond is the Atlanta Open, where Marty Fish is hoping to clinch the title for a third straight year. Big John Isner, who lost both finals to Fish, returns once again. And the final ATP event is on the Swedish clay of Gstaad. Exciting youngsters Bernard Tomic and Grigor Dimitrov will be hoping for a good run there. On the women's side, Carlsbad, California is the next stop on the US hard court season. 20-year-old Christina McHale leads a strong American charge. And it's the ladies' turn to play in Borstad at the Sony Swedish Open. Sara Errani will be looking to continue her great clay form, whilst Laura Robson, a semi-finalist in Palermo, will also be hoping to make a mark.
Tennis Weekly is a Sky Sports News Radio podcast.
So time's nearly up for this week, but first, Chris, it's time for you to select a player of the week.
I would say probably Leighton Hewitt.
Really? And not Laura Robson?
Well, yeah, Laura Robson. I was thinking male. I think you've got to have one for the male, one for the female. So Hewitt, because of he struggled and come back time and time again, now he's back into a final on Newport, Rhode Island. Obviously, on the ladies' side, yeah, it's got to be Laura Robson. So, yes.
And let's hope that she'll be Player of the Week many more times on the Tennis Weekly podcast. Well, many thanks to Chris Wilkinson, the former British number one, as well as Yves Allegro and Thomas Otton, and I suppose Alexander Dolgopolov. Any comments you have, don't hesitate to get in touch. You can tweet us at SSN Radio. And Chris and me, Adam Bates, are both on there too. Why not leave a review on iTunes as well and subscribe so you don't miss us next week when we return with Tennis Weekly.
The Tennis Weekly podcast.
The greatest, unquestionably, he was tonight.
At skysports.com/radio and on iTunes.
And the world's best is the best on a night to remember in New York.
Tennis Weekly is a Sky Sports News Radio podcast.